these at home.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to bring it, but I didn't want to.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Committee on Transportation Economic Development. Monday afternoon, 29th. We're going to proceed down our agenda, skipping the first bill, because we understand some people are on their way here and stuck in traffic. So we'll start with the public hearing on Senate Bill 534.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 534 permits non-attorneys to represent individuals at proceedings before Department of Transportation when proceedings involve registration of commercial vehicles.
Very good. And here comes Mr. Russell.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and this bill and the next one, ODOT discovered them after their deadline for introducing their own legislation, so they asked me to do them. They are both housekeeping. It took me a minute and a half to do them on the Senate side. And I'm sure it will take longer on this side.
Why would you say that?
Hey.
So we know how to read.
I think the bar is set. And they're two attorneys. Yes.
What Senate Bill 534 does is it allows non-attorneys to represent motor carriers for what's referred to as proportional registration. Unlike your car, where you can drive in any state with your license plate and you just pay your registration fees to your home state, trucks can't do that. We actually have to pay registration fees in every state in which we operate. But we do that through a Bay State program, which is called Prorate or IRP, and we pay a proportional share based on the number of miles that we operate in each of those states. The nice thing about it from our perspective is the whole program is operated by the Bay State. So all the Oregon trucking companies deal with Oregon, all the Washington companies deal with Washington, and the states transfer the money back and forth among themselves, and it works really kind of slick. This chapter was added to ODOT law late in terms of time, because truck regulation started in 1928 in Oregon, and this was added in about 1987.
Say that with some lack of confidence.
Well,
just kidding.
I added it. But when we did it, we had a base, another chapter of law that covered all of those chapters. When things got transferred to ODOT, we lost some of that continuity. So this particular chapter was not covered under the statute that allows non-attorneys to represent trucking companies in proceedings before ODOT. All this bill does is adds proportional registration to those things that non-attorneys can represent motor carriers before the Department of Transportation. That's it.
If the attorneys have any questions.
I take this as an affront to my profession.
Representative Davis.
Representative Pence, do you agree?
Of course.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pence.
I'm sure it's just a holdover from a previous time when people actually appreciated licensed lawyers doing their work for them, and now with the slippage of that concern about who represents whom, this is pretty normal. I'm not being harsh.
Right.
I'm just saying that's kind of the way it is. I would like to know what the original thinking was when they put the attorney requirement in. There must have been either back in the old days when there was more concern about that and or not. So maybe you could share that with us.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, actually it's the opposite. The attorneys are taking over rather than the non-attorneys in the transportation world. Back in the old days, we used to have what's called Class B practitioners, and you had to sit for an exam before the Interstate Commerce Commission, and then you got a certificate, and you could practice transportation law in front of only the regulatory bodies, not in the courts. So that's sort of the tradition way back then. And rather than in this chapter it's saying that people could only be represented by attorneys, it was silent. So they added non-attorneys in this case. There are very few Class B practitioners left. I happen to be one of them.
I do recall back in the age of regulation where that indeed was the case, and we actually had to bring an attorney, I think, out of Portland to assist over in Eastern Oregon for that purpose. It's been quite a while back. Yeah, I don't know. My thought here is this, as you just said, is just a bookkeeping measure, and that's all it amounts to. You said that earlier. I'm assuming that's still the case.
That's still the case.
Thank you.
Questions? Okay. You are the only person who has signed up.
Ms. Joyce would be happy to raise her hand.
Look how she's doing it so happily.
Right here. They've already taken more than a minute and a half on the House side.
I know. We've met our goal, haven't we? Ms. Joyce, anything you wanted to say? Or are you going to respond to questions? She doesn't need to say anything. Very good. Okay. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 534. Public hearing on Senate Bill 535. Joy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 535 removes limitation on width of rear mirrors used on vehicles.
Don't go anywhere, Mr. Russell. It's your turn again.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. This is another housekeeping change. It does not change the overall width measurement of trucks. All it does is exclude mirrors from the 6 inches of the mirrors for the current width measurement. The ODOT hasn't used this particular statute for a long time because, again, you've got an overall width measurement. Trucks have to be within that width measurement, so that it was immaterial. At the federal level, and the standard is that the mirrors have to be wide enough so that you can see 200 feet behind the vehicle. We already have that standard in state statute, but it's in another chapter. It's 815.235. So we're continuing to rely on the performance standard of being able to see 200 feet behind. There's no change in the overall width of the truck. It just takes this anachronistic statute or fixes it so that it's not confusing anymore. That's all it does.
Questions?
I think I'm confused.
Are you good, Davis?
Maybe I was confused. Mr. Chair,
go ahead, please.
Mr. Russell, could you say some of that again a little bit louder? I'm having just trouble hearing you. What's the problem we're trying to solve?
There is a little piece in statute, and it is on page 2 of the bill, line 1. And the words, by a distance of not greater than 5 inches on each side of the vehicle, is being removed from the existing statute.
Yeah, I understand that.
But further down in the bill, and the existing statute, it tells you that the overall width of the truck cannot be any longer than 102 inches, as I recall.
Gotcha.
I'd have to look at it. That doesn't change.
Gotcha.
So is there some reason is there a distinction between truck and mirror that is significant?
Mr. Chair, not that I'm aware of. What I was told is that these few words have been ignored for years, and someone felt like it was time to clean up the statute and remove them.
It's just a relic, then.
Correct.
Okay. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So who's in charge of enforcing if the rear view mirrors are not the right size, and is there a fine associated with whether or not you have the right size mirrors?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish. Absolutely. We go through extensive safety inspections and measurements. You see them most often at the ports of entry if you're coming down from Portland, mm-hmm. at the Woodburn Port of Entry, and there's a safety inspection building towards the back. Trucks are pulled in there all the time, and they are inspected for a variety of things, including if they think they're too wide, they measure them if they are too wide, actually they're put out of service until they fix it.
There you go. Okay.
Representative
Vince. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the mirror, is it measured when they're turned out to their full extent? The reason I ask is I made the mistake of trying to ride my bicycle out to Independence yesterday, and I was very happy there weren't any really wide mirrors on any of the cars I went zooming by me as I chugged along.
It's a nice ride. I don't know why that would be a mistake.
Gee, if I'd have known that, I got my Suburban.
And there wasn't a Suburban.
Don't you have a used box truck?
Box truck.
Yeah, I do.
Still trying to get rid of that thing.
Let me know next time, Representative, when you're going for a bike ride.
Yeah. So the question is,
serious.
If they crank those mirrors out, they must measure them to their maximum extent out from the side of the vehicle, not when they're folded back in. Is that a correct thought?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, that's correct.
Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much.
I'm
close the public hearing on Senate Bill 535. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 536. Troy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 536A authorizes the state agency by rule to implement program to locate on premises of agency devices or facilities that agency installs or has installed specifically delivered electronically to public for motor vehicles that use electricity for popularization. Authorizes agency to conduct with vendor to distribute, dispense, or otherwise make electricity available. Requires agency that contracts with vendor to require vendor to indemnify agency against claim using about vendor's operations on agency's premises and to obtain sufficient liability insurance.
Thank you.
You're
and we have no one signed up, but I'm guessing someone from ODOT is coming forward. Here we go.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Art James. I work in the Office of Innovative Partnerships with the Department of Transportation. And I've been fortunate for the last 4 years or so to be working in the electric vehicle space here in Oregon. And things have changed rather dramatically during that period of time. I included as a handout a flyer that we put together for the Portland Auto Show that talks about the West Coast Electric Highway. And on the inside of that flyer, there's a map that talks about some of the charging stations and infrastructure that ODOT has been able to install around the state using federal funds. We have been very fortunate to receive an ARRA grant early on from the Department of Energy. We installed the first leg of the West Coast Electric Highway in Southern Oregon. We subsequently received another grant from the U.S. Department of Transportation, the only such grant that they've given in the nation, actually. And we're installing an additional 33 fast charge stations around the state. Some of these stations have been installed at public facilities, including city facilities, county facilities, but we have been unable to install them at state facilities because there was no specific authority for that. So the bill as introduced, Senate Bill 536, basically just provided authority for state agencies to provide charging facilities. It didn't mandate that they do it, but allowed that as long as it was within their resources and they weren't in any way subsidizing those operations. Interestingly enough, when it was on the Senate side, Legislative Fiscal Office took a look at it, and when you have permissive language in a bill, they automatically assume that all agencies are going to do anything they can do to the maximum extent possible. So there was a big fiscal impact on the original bill, and that caused us to create some amendments on the Senate side to put sideboards on that so that there are a limited number that any agency might install in any given biennium. And so I'm happy to answer questions, anything that you have about electric vehicles, electric vehicle charging. There are over 700 electric vehicle charging stations in Oregon today. We had a similar bill in 2011 which didn't pass. But just to give you a sense of the scale of this, in 2011, when this committee heard that bill, there were no publicly available charging stations in the state. Today, there are over 800, and we have more than 2,500 plug-in electric vehicles. They're driving around all the time, and you can see them here in Salem, around the Portland area, and clear down in southern Oregon. So I'll close my testimony there and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. I imagine we will have some questions. Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much use are these 800 stations currently getting?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Betts, there are different vendors that are installing these. So we get data on the ones that ODOT has installed, and that use has been increasing month by month. In some cases, for instance, the facility that we installed in Springfield, that gets the most monthly use of any ODOT station that's been installed. But because of the source of our grant, our stations are being installed in non-urbanized areas. So another company called Equitality has been installing much of the equipment that's used in the Portland area. And they have a website that records that use on a monthly basis.
Can I follow up on that? Have you noticed, I imagine if you took any given individual charger, the location might be a factor, the technology might be a factor, and there's probably a whole host of other things I'm not thinking of at the moment, but have you got enough in that 800 to start to say this technology or this brand is more popular than, it's getting better use than this one? Have you started to draw conclusions about the technology and location and what matters?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. There are some of the knowledge is anecdotal at this point, but we actually cooperated with Washington Department of Transportation in developing criteria for host sites. And so Washington and Oregon have been using the same criteria for the West Coast Electric Highway, and we use things like, are there ancillary services for drivers to use while they're charging? Because depending on the vehicle and the level of the charge, they may be there for anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes to 2 hours, depending on what the situation is. We want to make sure that they're safe locations, that they're lighted at night, that they have adequate power. Some of these fast chargers take a 480 volt three-phase connection, which is like an industrial strength connection, and so just finding out places that have that level of power limits the field somewhat. So all of those factors, and for a level two charger, for instance, you want a place that somebody's going to be for a while. So a restaurant, a movie theater, motels. A lot of the motels on the coast right now are putting in level two because they want to draw EV drivers from the valley to stay over on the coast. So it's a big draw if the only motel in Yahats has an EV charger, say.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a blog or more than one blog, either that the State Department of Transportation allows use of, or industry, or just people who get together, associations, to discuss this? If there is someone monitoring the blogs to see what people are saying about the different locations, the convenience factor, and so forth?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nathanson, the Oregon Electric Vehicle Association, or OEVA, has a website, and they have all kinds of testimonials in there by people that are using the network. And it's been really encouraging to us because every time we announce that we open up a new site, these groups of EV drivers want to be the first ones to kind of challenge that route. And so we see them, the pioneers, if you will, and we see lots of testimonials from them, basically giving ODOT a huge slap on the back for doing this work.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you talk about the revenue that's produced? I noticed the revenue statement says there is no revenue. However, in private facilities, I know that there are incentives to install these and create revenue. Can you talk a little bit about why the state wouldn't be looking at some of that, or maybe they are down the road? Just
for us?
Sure. Mr. Chairman and Representative Cameron, one of the reasons that the bill in 2011 didn't move forward is none of the companies that were doing this at the time had the ability to charge people. And so this is so new that whole mechanism is really just started standing up about 18 months ago. So the Ecotality company that I mentioned, their network is called the Blink. And you get a Blink card when you drive their network. It's got an RFID chip on the back. So I can take this down to Mission Mill or the Salem Riverfront or the Public Library or the Chemeketa Parkade. I can drive my EV up to it, swipe this card, plug it in, and then I will be charged for the time that I'm there. You're not charged by the amount of electricity that's going into your battery because electricity is cheap. If I were to park at the riverfront, say, for 2 hours, the amount of electricity, given PGE rates, that would go into my battery would be somewhere around maybe 25 to 30 cents. But the Ecotality is charging me $1 an hour to be connected to their network. And so that's how they generate revenue. Their agreement with the City of Salem in that case is they have a revenue sharing portion of that. I think it's 5%. But the reality is it's not a tremendous amount of money because EVs are so cheap to drive. Did that answer your question?
A follow-up with me. Well, so as they're putting these, as we're putting these things in on state property, is there contracts that are being drawn up as there are more and more EVs and more opportunity for revenue, are the contracts going to be revenue generating?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, the contracts will vary. In most cases, we want to make sure that the state isn't subsidizing the operation, and that's where the language in the bill that says that we're not going to be subsidizing the private operator. Because there are a few number of vehicles right now, although rising, it's going to be a long time before this actually starts throwing off any revenue of any consequence. But there is a revenue sharing portion in there so that if the numbers did ramp up at some point, that there would be a sharing of revenue. The same contracts are now being used, as I said, with local governments around the state.
So maybe we could take, build on Representative Cameron's question, sir, take us through the next few years in a scenario. Imagine the bill passes. How do you foresee the rollout of this infrastructure going, the state's role in it, and what's going to happen?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're sort of wrapping up the two federally funded projects that we have right now. By this time next year, we should have about 43 fast chargers installed along major transportation routes in the state. The Ecotality project is kind of wrapping up, too. By the end of the year, they will have put in all of the charging infrastructure that they were under contract with the Department of Energy. And there are...
U.S. Department of Energy?
Okay. U.S. Department of Energy. And there are additional companies that are installing. There are probably 12 firms right now in Oregon that are installing charging infrastructure. So at some point, and this is just Art James speaking, I believe that this whole activity is going to be taken over by the private sector as the number of vehicles get up to a critical mass and there's sufficient room in the game for entrance. Right now, there are some barriers to entry. I showed you the key or the card, the Blink card. This is another vendor called Ecotality. In order to activate their units in Oregon, you have to have a key fob that looks like this.
Is that a different? I think you said Ecotality is Blink. Is that a different one?
This one is AeroVironment.
Okay.
AeroVironment is actually installing the West Coast Electric Highway fast chargers for us. They're under contract with ODOT. So another company. Pretty soon, I think this all has to get put, as in a back office and be as transparent to the user as cell phones are now. But right now, it's like early days of cell phones where you had roaming charges and this plan and that plan. That's something that I spoke at a conference earlier this year in Washington D.C. and the industry is is well aware that that's something from a user standpoint they've got to fix.
Can't all be carrying the individual fob?
Oh yeah, I mean, card. Pockets full of cards and you know things to make make it go.
Right. Okay. Representative Davis, and then Representative Benz.
Thank you, Chair. I want to go back to the bill a little bit and what it actually authorizes, the cost that we expect. I'll start with those two questions. So this bill is authorizing state agencies to install these, but it can't subsidize operations of a private entity, and activities must do not substantially exceed the cost of the state agency of making the electricity available. So in practice, how is this going to work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davis, we believe that there will be additional opportunities to access federal funding for charging infrastructure. I know this is something that's been touted at the administration level. It's something that Senator Merkley is close to his heart, and he's been working on in Washington. A state agency is going to, in all cases, I would say, or almost all, contract with a third party to have them come in and install the equipment, operate and maintain it, and charge drivers for the use of that. We say state facilities, which is broadly interpreted. I would doubt that it would be a fish hatchery, say, in, you know, Malheur County that would put one in, because there aren't going to be many EV drivers going there. But where there are strategic locations that can actually help educate the public about the advantages of electric transportation, I think that the state has a role to play to sort of raise the public awareness in that regard.
Can you follow up?
Please.
So it's not free, neither to the user nor to the state. So what does it mean? What does the bill mean when it says the state agency shall ensure the activities described under this section do not substantially exceed the cost to the state agency of making the electricity available? Is that the sort of the revenue sharing thing you're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davis, that's correct, right? We're not proposing that this be a revenue source for the agency. It's kind of a break-even proposition, if you will.
Okay. Follow up. I'm thinking more of, I don't want this to be just another way for the agency to figure out to spend some money. So this is essentially going to try to have this be a revenue neutral proposition. Is that the idea?
Representative Reed and Representative Davis, yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to follow up on that, the material indicates that one of these stations costs between $7,000 and $12,500. And that's for one car, is that correct? Or can you plug more than one into that station?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, those figures came from the Legislative Fiscal Office, and I don't know exactly where they got them. The equipment itself for a level 2 charger, which is a 240 volt, 40 amp connection, those vary. A public charger might go anywhere from, say, $3,500 to $5,000. The cost of installation really depends widely on how much concrete, asphalt you have to tear up, how far you have to trench, hooking in a new panel, all of that other, and it can vary greatly. Once you put in the infrastructure to wherever the charging site is, you could put as many chargers as you want there. As an example, the Woodburn Interchange is going to be a park and ride that ODOT is currently on our STIP going to be constructing. They're putting in conduit in the ground for up to 50 charging stations because it's cheap. It's all torn up. You're just going to run plastic pipe. Whether or not and how many charging stations will actually be installed at that facility will be a decision that's determined down the road, but at least the underground infrastructure will be there to put quite a few of them in there.
Hold on, please. So the question, going back to Representative Davis's question, where the bill reads, subsidize the operations of the entity. It says operations. what I think we were all trying to get at is whether the whatever the cost may be, five, three, seven, 12, whatever thousands of dollars it is, the concept is to recover that amount plus the cost of the electricity. Is that how you read the bill?
Chairman Reed, Representative Bentz, yes, so that's the intent, that the third party actually is going to provide the equipment, do the operation and maintenance, and then recoup its cost over time through user fees.
I guess what I'm getting at is that it seems as though the state agency, if it had it in its budget, could go ahead and install these, or DAS could, using state money for doing so. This bill doesn't require that we use third parties to do it. Is my reading of this correct?
That's correct.
Would you anticipate then that folks, that state agencies would be using state money to install these, or is your anticipation that we'd never see state money used, instead it would always be a third party with some sort of an arrangement where they're bearing the risk for the amount of use?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, there may be situations, and really to the bill, the reason it has a limit on DAS is because DAS operates a lot of the facilities, particularly in the Salem area, and it may be that they can do more than any other agency because they have control over more facilities.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I heard the answer. The question is, will the state be paying, or will a third party be paying for the installation of these machines? That's my question.
The intent is that the state is not going to be paying for the installation of the machines.
Okay, thank you.
Questions?
Maybe I should clarify, because it says in the subsection C that the state may have or installed more than that number of locations if the state agency obtains a grant to support that. This is in anticipation of more federal grant funding that may be coming down the line in the future.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions. I'll look up and down here. But we do have one other person who wants to testify on the bill, Mr. Esmond.
Good afternoon.
I have microphones, Mr. Esmond. Don't forget.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Esmond with the IBW 48 in Portland, Oregon. Excuse my being, I was back east doing the same thing, so you have to excuse me. We are supportive of this. We have been supportive of the EV business movement the past 4 or 5 years. And truth be known, I'm on the board of Drive Oregon, which is trying to help promote this industry, promote small businesses in this state to find some opportunities. I've been involved in we have 9 charging stations, level 2, and we just got a 3-phase charging station at our Union Hall, which is about 60 blocks from the airport. As a destination place, our people are well trained in this, and we have worked with Art for many years, and we're all for it. In short,
thank you, sir.
I'll take any questions if you want. I know I'm stumbling.
Doing just fine. Thank you, Mr. Chesman. Any questions for him? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And anyone else want to be heard on Senate Bill 536? See any, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 536. And our last item for the day is a hearing on Senate Bill 238.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 238 allows a child under 7 years of age to operate a Class 3 all-terrain vehicle on public lands if the child meets rider fit guidelines established by the State Board of Parks and Recreation. Specifies that children under 16 years of age must meet rider fit guidelines to operate Class 3 all-terrain vehicles on public lands.
We have 3 people who have signed to testify, so since we have 3 chairs, we'll call them all up at once. Ethan Lodwig, Ed Arniello, and Tim Cowan. Thank you. You could sense my lack of confidence in it.
afternoon. My name is Ethan Ludwig. I live in Eugene, Oregon. Thank you for this opportunity to speak about SB 238. I included a packet for you so that my nervousness will hopefully not exclude too much information, but thought I'd go through it. As a little background of me, I'm a father of two children. I'm also a off-highway motorcycle enthusiast. I've been a registered nurse for over 20 years in the emergency department. I have national certifications for trauma, emergency nursing, pediatric advanced life support, emergency nursing for pediatrics. I have a master's degree in community health education. I've also spent the last 25 years on my weekends going to off-road motorcycling events where I've staffed with the organization that's put it together, as well as done search and rescue opportunities as first responder for injuries. I'm a member of the Emerald Trail Rider Association and the Oregon Motorcycle Riders Association. SB 238 came about in that it gets rid of the minimum age for motorcycle riders, which is currently 7 years old, to ride on public lands. This bill is about helping families recreate together outside enjoying our public lands. It's about making motorcycle riding safer for all Oregon youths. It also helps our economy and kind of fixes the state law to be more consistent for law enforcement and our families to understand. Very few of us in the community knew that it was illegal for kids under 7 to ride motorcycles on public lands until 2 years ago when HB 2329 passed. And that bill sort of reiterated that it was illegal for us to do that. For the past 30 years, our kids start riding bicycles, and they get out. Once they get off their training wheels and they get good on two-wheelers, we introduce them to youth motorcycles in a stepwise fashion. The American Motorcycle Riders Association holds racing events for kids 4 and up. These kids are already out riding. It's not that this bill will all of a sudden open the door. They're already out there. You know, we take them out on supervised rides. And how this works is all week we get ready by prepping motorcycles and an RV, and the family gets all excited. And then Friday night we take them off for a race event on Saturday where our kids race, the adults race. Everybody has a good time. Then Sunday, we go riding in a public riding area. Only lately, our kids get tickets for, in fact, we get tickets for, I think, child endangerment, which seems odd. We're out on a supervised ride taking care of our kids, just like you would take your child bicycle riding. The proposed change in SB 238 was unanimously approved by Oregon's All-Terrain Vehicle Advisory Committee. It's supported by the Off-Highway Vehicle Community in Oregon, the American Motorcycle Riders Association, in that it puts rider fit in its place. And rider fit is the best way to guarantee the safety of off-highway vehicle motorcycle operators, in that the person fits the machine that they're riding. Since the implementation of the rider fit of the YSEP program, which Ed's going to talk about in a little bit, we haven't had one death under the age of 15 in Oregon, which is a tremendous accomplishment on all OHVs. Recreating on off-highway vehicles is very important to Oregon families and in the United States. Studies have shown that roughly 20 to 22% of Oregon's population, as well as the United States populations, recreate on OHVs. For Oregon, that means that roughly $541 million comes into the state directly related to off-highway vehicle recreation. And that money helps support rural economies, the rural economies of Oregon. Currently, it's kind of confusing for families and law enforcement because quads have a rider fit law and no minimum age, while motorcycle riders have a minimum age of 7 and no rider fit law. SB 238 is a it's a proactive approach that promotes responsible and safe riding. You know, our national injury rates are very low. People get worried about the word motorcycle. It conjures up all kinds of emotions. But from the data, it shows us that nationally, when this is studied in the United States, there's about 1,100 injuries on off-highway motorcycles in the age group of 4 to 7. Now, that's a lot, and every injury gives us the opportunity to learn from it. But if you look at other sports and how other family-oriented sports injuries go, in particular, bicycle riding injuries for the United States is 85,770 for the same age group. And if you look at ball sports injuries, it's 63,000. So those are the kids playing basketball and baseball in the same age group. So there's a significant increase in other sports. And for Oregon, we use the Oregon Trauma System as entries into the trauma database as a way to track injuries in Oregon. Now, youth motorcycles has been studied in the past, but not for a few years. Back in between the years of 1998 and 2003, the total number of off-highway motorcycle injuries that were entered into the Oregon Trauma System was 76 per year. Now, that compares with the annual bicycle injury rate that gets entered into the trauma system of 992. So, overall, not many people are getting injured on off-highway motorcycles. The minimum age is a bit arbitrary. As I said, most of our kids start riding when they're ready. All kids start when they're ready when they're supervised with us. But the minimum age is 7. The children don't magically inherit good judgment at a minimum age. So risk-taking behavior begins in the early teens and proceeds through the mid-20s. Children learn good behavior and judgment and responsible decision-making as they develop from infancy through adulthood and beyond, hopefully, through education, guidance, and practice. You don't teach your child how to use a knife with food by giving them a sharp knife and an apple. You start out with a butter knife with a banana. And this type of education is how we teach our kids good skills and good judgment in a stepwise fashion consistent with their abilities. Through the years, they learn stopping distance, maneuverability of vehicles, mechanics, and operation of vehicles with other vehicles around them. There's no specific minimum age when to teach children good judgment. The only requirement is that we spend time with them and that we work with them. So, in closing, I'd just like to say that the Emerald Trail Riders Association, the American Motorcycle Riders Association, Oregon's All-Terrain Vehicle Advisory Committee all support this change. And I welcome any questions that I'll try to answer for you.
Appreciate your testimony. Let's hear from the rest of the panel and then we'll see if there are questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed, representatives, members of the committee. My name is Ed Arenello. I'm president of the Oregon Motorcycle Riders Association. We've been promoting, advocating, supporting programs for responsible riding since 1972. We are the statewide agency or association for representing OHV users across the board, predominantly in the motorcycle area because that's where our roots began. I'm also a father of a 9-year-old daughter, been successfully riding an ATV for over 4 years. Off and on, between preferences, she rides her motorcycle at night in the dark around the yard. And I remember when my father first let go of me on a tricycle. And I remember when I let go of my now 21-year-old son when he had training wheels going down the sidewalk. Parents remember. Parents are responsible. We judge when we let go. We judge how many times around the house we run on a bike, with a bike handlebars in our hands, or a motorcycle, or an ATV. We make good judgments on when we take the child locks off the doors in our house. We make good judgments when they can work the washing machine. and we make good judgments when they use recreational equipment, be it football, basketballs, the bicycle. Which is more dangerous? My stepson going 35, 45 miles an hour downhill ski bowl in the middle of the summer? Or my son or daughter going across a flat trail? Somebody must decide. And that is the parent. That is the responsible party. So we've been representing the OHV community since 1972. But moreover, we have partnered with Oregon Parks and Recreation Department for years and law enforcement in making OHV use, particularly in the motorcycle and ATV areas, safer.
Sorry, no, I'm sorry to interrupt. You don't need to lean into the microphone. Oh, it works okay. Just fine. So
that's good.
So I'm relaxed and okay. We can hear you fine.
I'm a passionate Italian.
That's fine. That's
fine. You don't have to do so, I appreciate that. So we were there with Senate Bill 101, and we helped design this rider fit for ATVs. We went out with our kids. One of our directors has 10 kids. So we tested all these kids, and everybody brought their kids. And we tested where they fit, what worked on ATVs, and happened to do motorcycles at the same time. I was a member of the group that wrote the administrative rules on rider fit. And we really put a lot of thought in this, and Oregon Parks Recreation Department really made sure it worked. And the numbers prove it. We've worked consistently with the ATV Advisory Committee. We've been discussing this with them. And moreover, they've been suggesting to us to come and support a rider fit bill for motorcycles because it is the right thing to do for years. And we thought we should wait until the numbers were in, that we could see that it worked and see that the public would accept it. And the time is now. So we're in full support of this because it is a better program. A week and a half ago, I was at the OPRD law enforcement workshop in Redmond, and I asked many of the 77 attendees, all of which law enforcement officers. And then I asked the group, and there was no question that this is safer, is easier to enforce, and it will make for a more responsible community. So with that, I encourage that you support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Chairman Reed, committee members, my name is Tim Cowan, and I'm speaking as an individual. The reason why, when I looked at the bill, I was interested in it is because in football, in college, I had concussions, primarily through the chin. My son, when he was a freshman in high school, suffered a neck injury as a result of playing football. Looking at the Academy of Pediatrics, there's 20 times more likely to die from a motorcycle accident than you are in an automobile accident. The injury is usually caused when you run into something. Brain injury can still occur when you have a helmet on. I'm getting this from the Academy of Pediatrics. The Academy of Pediatrics does not support a young person riding a motorcycle before they reach the same age as someone can get a driver's license. So obviously, as they get younger, that's an issue. The pediatric doctor that I talked to said that sometimes the bones have not fully developed when you're younger, and when you break them, the long ones, it can cause them to be shorter if it's in a leg or an arm, one shorter than the other one. So I would like to have consideration made that when someone is that young, that when they do have an injury, it's more severe than when you're older. And I am not a doctor. I only did the research based on what happened to me and my son. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There are questions? Representative McHugh.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Could you characterize for me how this is implemented? So you have a child who's under 16, and they have to meet the rider fit guidelines. How does that happen? Where do they go? Are they tested? They have to have a card. Can you just explain the process to me, please?
That's a great question, Representative McCowan and Chair Reed, members of the committee.
McEwen.
Today, we have been working with OPRD on developing a safety education program. Today, you, in order to ride an ATV in Oregon up through the age of 59, and next year, everyone, including myself, so you have to go to the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department website, and you have to take a quiz. And it is a long quiz. It takes 45 minutes to an hour and 15 minutes. And it is an education program that walks you through. Then you answer several questions, tells you what's safe, what's not, what rider fit is, what terrain is safe. You answer some questions, and then there's a 50-question final exam at the end. And so that, in partnership with your parents or today on your own, you go and you really do learn all those proper tools that are necessary to go ride on public lands. You may be practicing in your yard or on your property, but in order to go on public lands, you need to take that course. We also, the OMRA is the administrator statewide, working with OPRD and some other private groups to have a youth safety certification, which is hands-on. And so those youth need to go to this course. They need to demonstrate their abilities, not necessarily be trained at this point. That's coming in the future. But they need to go and demonstrate that they fit the equipment they have, that they are properly protected with a proper helmet and proper gear to protect other extremities, that they can reach the levers, that they can reach the ground, and all of these safe factors. Then they get a certification. Then they're permitted to ride on public land.
That's for use under the age of 16. They have to go through the youth safety evaluation program. Everyone has to do the online safety training.
So are you expecting a 4 or 5 or 6 year old child to go through that process?
If you notice the pictures on the back.
I'm reading the bill.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. Yes, we have our kids. If when we take our kids out and you teach them how to ride a bicycle, they start out in a stepwise, gradual fashion. They don't start out immediately riding on two wheels at doing maneuvers down the bike path. When kids start out, they start out slow. They have the vehicles have governors on them, which go from zero to. They're gradual governors that they can go from zero walking speed on up to 10, 15 miles an hour. And so we go through the online safety training with our kids. We go through the concepts with our kids. And then they're exposed to the youth safety evaluation program, which, again, teaches them proper safety equipment, what to do on the trail if you come across other trail users. How to respect wildlife, stay on the trail, concepts that are gradual. So,
who administers that test then? Does the state Parks and Rec Department have oversight of actually having that child come to a Parks and Rec event and somebody is judging their rider fitness? Is that correct?
They manage the program and they certify whether or not we're capable, and they make sure that we follow the rules.
You as the parent, or we being
no.
The child?
Okay, so Oregon Parks and Recreation Department administers the entire program, and they certify certain individuals to do the hands-on certification, but they manage the course online that the parent takes the kids to or goes to themselves. Does that answer the question?
So the child shows competency at a youth safety evaluation program.
After
taking the online safety training.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
I guess I'm having a little bit of trouble with seeing a five-year-old sit down and go through a lengthy hour and 15-minute online class. Can you explain to me how that benefits a five-year-old?
Could probably do it better if my daughter was here, because that's when she took it. She sits through, you walk through, whether it's math, social studies, a science project, OMSI, whatever, you walk through every one of the steps. And then you make sure that they answer the questions and you click the right answer.
Follow up.
So I got to jump in there. Who clicks?
Yeah.
either the five-year-olds today can click. Okay, sure. They can read.
But how do we know it's the five-year-old and not the parent?
Yeah.
I'll defer to parental responsibility. Will there be parents that will go out there and administer any test at any age? If they could, they'd probably take the driver's test at 16 for their kids.
Just part of the reason we have some requirements that can't happen.
Right, but today, if you look at the ATV numbers, ATVs, not the motorcycle numbers, we can see significant improvement in the process that exists today that Oregon Parks and Recreation put together.
Sorry, I jumped in. Follow up.
I'm sorry, Chair Reed. I'm just fascinated by this. So if is this academically geared to a 4 or 5 year old, or are they walking through this hour-long test that's geared at an adult reading level?
No, it was made at a lower gear. I can't remember the exact level that we targeted, but I think it was between third and fifth grade level, so that when you're talking to your child, they can understand the concepts of what you're saying. There are illustrations that you can refer to. So a lot of education in there.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Follow up. And the way I understand what you were saying is you're trying to align this program with the same one you already have for quads. So you're taking the rider fit, basically the criteria, and applying this to motorcycles. Is that the whole idea of what we're trying to accomplish here?
It's a basic level, but there are two different sets of rider fit qualifications.
The concept is line these two programs up.
If you can safely operate this, then, well, it's to line youth and families and the recreation up correctly. That's the real purpose. It happens to be that there's rider fit for ATVs, but it is to line up responsible youth education, training, sharing of knowledge when it's appropriate, rather than stating some age.
Okay. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Doherty.
So the way I read the bill, there is no age minimum for a child to do this.
Rider fit is the age.
Okay.
And that's pretty stringent.
Well, I agree with Representative McEwen. I'm having a hard time, you know, dealing with kids to have a 4 or 5 year old comprehend what they're doing. But, you know, I just can't understand why you didn't want to keep the language, the current language, which, I granted, you added that rider fit, but you deleted the language of a child under 7. Mm-hmm. So, and I can't understand why.
Because our youth, whether it's in our yards, on our property, or you can watch it on Saturdays on some of the motocross channels, of course those guys are extreme, this is just purely about recreation. They're, by rider fit, that will determine the capability of any person. I mean, a person my age may not be able to fit a particular ATV or motorcycle, depending on the size. So rider fit is critical. It also helps align the right size piece of equipment with the right person, just like fitting a helmet. Yeah. If it doesn't fit right, you're in trouble. It has to fit right.
And I understand that. I just have trouble with the judgment of a 4 or 5 year old. So,
ma'am, Representative Doherty, the reason that we're here and trying to bring this information forward is that those concepts are hard for people outside of our community. Being that only a quarter of us in the population of Oregon recreate on OHVs, there are lots of 75% don't, and we understand that. But what we're trying to convey to you is that our kids, if you notice the photos I've included, everyone in those photographs is under the age of 7. They're out there. They're out there racing. They're out there riding. It only became apparent to us that this was illegal a few years ago. If you have experience teaching kids how to ride bicycles and tricycles, they start pretty young. And we, being that we've done this our whole lives, we do this every weekend, as well as the one quarter other percentage, or the 20% of the rest of the population in Oregon do this. You'd have to come to one of our events to understand that these kids are very proficient. And by the time they hit 7 or 8 years old, they're ready for their second one. They're ready to move up. These motorcycles have seat heights of 18 inches. They weigh 47 pounds. So my kid's bicycle weighs 20 pounds.
It's a heavy bike.
It is. It's, yeah, anyway, I don't want to digress too much. But the point is they're already doing it. They've been doing it. We've all been doing it for 30 years. And you can refer to the injury rates that I presented before, that this has not been a big problem. I don't see it much in the emergency department. I don't see these kids come in because they're wearing lots of equipment. Bicycle riders wear a pair of shorts and hopefully a helmet. These kids are wearing neck braces and chest protectors and boots that go up to their knees, and they're well protected.
Is it Lodwig?
Yes.
Just to clarify something you just said, I think you misspoke. You said you didn't realize until recently this was illegal. It's not illegal on private lands, right?
That's correct.
Okay. We're just talking about public lands at this point.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
So whether or not we do anything here, it's still going to happen on private land.
Yes, sir. The reason, part of the reason this came about was that as I spoke, we'll all go for a race on Saturday, and then on Sunday we'll go for a ride, and unfortunately these people are getting tickets now, which are unfortunate.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative McEwen?
Just one more. Chair Reed, thank you. I'm struggling with this, obviously. I live in Coos Bay. We have the National Dunes Recreation Area, and that ER is buzzing all summer. These injuries are the bread and butter of what happens in our hospital in the summertime. And granted, a lot of that comes from people using poor judgment.
Yep, ma'am.
And maybe they are not rider fit or trained well or understand how to operate their OHV or their motorcycle, but it happens every single day out there. We just had one this week. So I guess my concern is, how do you legislate good judgment of a parent who has a 6 or 7 year old who may not be able to be as astute as you are and as well prepared and well trained as you are in managing this? And so I don't know where you go with this. But, I mean, I had a neighbor who put their 7-year-old on a quad, and the thing got away from him, flipped over, and circled over the kid about 10 times, and just beat the heck out of this little guy until he finally figured out how Dad went over and stopped it. Bad things can happen. And sometimes you can't legislate that. I understand that. But I do hear your passion, and I know as parents, you're doing the right thing and handling your children's situations well, and I hope you're not the exception, I guess, is what I'd like to say.
Well, you want to say that? So, speaking specifically to the motorcycles, of course, I will tell you that I went from having no wheeled vehicles, recreational vehicles other than bicycles, skateboards, and scooters, to many quads at the age of 42 with my kids. And so they were pretty young at the time, and we all broke ourselves in at the dunes, staying at the KOA in North
Nice Bend. And soft when you fall.
And, nice and soft. But I also grew up skiing at the time when there were no helmets, no nothing, and my dad let go of me, and off you go, and you stumble, fall, whatever it is, right? But he somehow figured out when the right time was, because here I am. And I still can't figure out why people run into trees when they ski, but I get it. It happens. It happens. So this weekend, there was an event at, in Eastern Oregon, and there were over 350 riders there, and there were many families. And everyone over the age of 7 could participate in trail riding while they were waiting for the event. They could participate in the festivities. And many of the parents brought their kids little bikes like here in the picture. Now, the good news is these people were all thinking about responsible riding. They really were. But I will tell you that on Saturday afternoon, two young men that we don't know, that weren't there for our event, that were just recreating, that were probably in that dangerous age where some people I know have been in the Coos Bay Hospital, they ran into each other. I have no idea how you would decide when there was dust coming in the opposite direction, you would not pull over and stop, but they ran into each other, and one young man was life-flighted. I mean, that is sad. But they are well over the age and on their own. And these kids drove themselves in their four-wheel drive trucks to get there because I heard them talk, people talking about how to get at home and that. And that isn't happened. But their parents made some error in judgment earlier. We're saying if we made those good judgments, if we spent that time with our kids and didn't wait until they went down and learned what they could do at the dunes and sneak their alcohol here and there and have that fun and jump when they shouldn't without a spotter, and then all of a sudden we have accidents, we'd like to train them earlier. You know, we'd like to train them early.
Representative McGowan, McEwen, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
The other thing, you bring up a distinction, an important distinction, too. The incident that you cited sounded like a small child on a large quad, and Rider Fit was specifically designed to address that issue. Rider Fit is supported by, I'm sorry, I'd have to look it up, but I believe the American College of Surgeons because of this problem. And so SB 101 was put into place to address that. We want the same benefit for our kids out riding motorcycles. Motorcycles are a little different because if you can't stand it up, it falls over.
That's right.
Motorcycles weigh, I'm going to guess the average, like I said, these motorcycles that we're talking about weigh anywhere from 40 to 100 pounds. Whereas a small size quad or even a larger quad can weigh upwards of 400 to 500 pounds. And hence, the things that happen at, while any injury is unfortunate and could be learned from, there are the amount of injuries that we see on motorcycles, just it doesn't happen the same as other motorized recreational vehicles.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So I've kind of just been listening to this because I don't particularly want my kids on a motorcycle, or I don't go on them or on any of these outdoor recreational vehicles, and I know people who love them and do this, and it's great. And I think about my own kids up on a ski lift, my 5-year-old going up and skiing Black Diamond runs. Was he ready to do that? I don't know. But he did it, and
no.
all my kids are Black Diamond skiers, so, you know, but it still makes mom nervous, even with helmets and everything. I guess the interesting thing for me, and maybe you know or don't know, you know, I kind of liken what you're talking about that. Is your child ready? You know, when my husband was deployed, one of the first things I did was I called the police department, and I said, what's the law say about me leaving my kids at home? Because I'm not taking three kids to the grocery store to get milk. So that's just not going to work. And the answer I got back was, well, there really is kind of no rule. It's really about your judgment. If you're out at the bar at 3 o'clock in the morning and your house burns down and you left your kids, we're going to get you for criminal neglect. And I guess the question I have is, but imagine this falls under that same, when a parent uses bad judgment and a child gets hurt, we have criminal policies for that, don't we? I mean, it just, we do for other areas of the law. I would imagine that criminal neglect of your child, if your child gets hurt on one of these things, it's kind of on the parent, and somebody's going to come cite you, CPS or whoever, for not being a good parent.
Yeah, Chair Reed, I'm figuring this out. And Representative Parrish, there are the current laws also state that children under the age of 16 have to be supervised by an adult who has gone through the online safety training. So, and can render immediate assistance. Thank you. These children under the age of 16 have to be monitored by their parents, and the parents can be cited for child endangerment should they be in a bad situation.
Thank you. See anyone else who's signed up to testify, unless there are any of the other three people in the back who want to be heard on the bill. Close the public hearing. Before we do, I'm not a motorcyclist, but a non-motorized cyclist. I actually, this weekend, happened to read a fascinating and lengthy article in a publication not generally known for lengthy articles or scholarly ones, Bicycling Magazine, about helmets and the lack of progress in developing helmets and some of the new designs and so on. So you may check that out if you haven't already. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 238. Unless there's anything else to come before the committee today, we have exhausted our agenda.
This isn't true.
And we're adjourned.
Chair.